Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink, inspiring public curiosity about food. Learn more at mofad.org.
This week on Meatin' 3, we bring you stories about the coldest, darkest season. We start in a California vineyard.
It's cold, but it's wet, and things are still alive. There's a lot of life in this soil.
We explore two frontiers of cocktail culture: luxury ice, and the rise of non-alcoholic drinks.
The rocks traditionally becomes 25% of your drink's volume, and as such, it imparts smells and tastes.
And we investigate the risks facing New York City delivery workers during the harsh winter.
In the wintertime, after 2 hours of biking, it's quite easy, actually, for the bikes to sting upside down or slips or slide.
Tune in to this week's episode of Meat and Three, that's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E, for some food for thought to sustain you through the dead of winter. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll load. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues that Sam is gonna get you some.
Welcome back to The Speakeasy. I'm Souther Teague. Damon Bolte is off in California where it's much more delightful weather. That's okay. The show must go on. So here we go in the studio here. Hey, thanks, bud. Here we go in the studio at HRN in the back of Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. We got our special guest, Mark Maynard from Union Square Hospitality Group. Welcome to the studio, Mark.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's good to see you.
Again.
Yeah, you got a lot of stuff going on. A
little bit. Keep up with you, bro.
Let's come on. We are similar in age, which I just found out. And I'm shocked to know it.
We are.
I didn't think you were that old.
You look a lot better.
Oh, come on. It's the Mutual Admiration Society all of a sudden.
Yeah. Don't believe anything.
Yeah. So we got you on because we want to talk to you about a lot of things. So Union Square Hospitality Group, let's talk about that a little bit and your own career for a minute, and then we'll jump into what you're up to these days, because it's pretty fascinating to me. You mentioned to me before we got on the air that you've been with them for 26 years.
Yeah, which is officially half of my life, which is pretty cool.
I mean, that's a lot of people's entire lives.
Yeah.
A lot of the people that I work with,
exactly. Yeah, right.
That's their entire
exactly.
life.
Exactly, and a lot of the people we take care of every day, which is very true at Porchlight for sure. I like so many people in our industry, in the bar and restaurant industry. I was someone who kind of fell into it. I grew up in a culinary family. I know you're a chef. My mother was a chef, so I was always her prep cook and busboy growing up, which is pretty cool. I actually was a designer. I studied landscape architecture and ended up in the restaurant business at Union Square Cafe in New York City. That was my first job in New York, which is pretty cool. Just because I was looking for a little extra work, a little side hustle.
Yeah, right.
While you're
finding your feet as a
young
man.
Yeah, exactly. And I had just moved to New York from Vermont. And for anyone who's listening, New York is a lot more expensive than Vermont. So now I really empathize.
Secret revealed.
Yeah, secret revealed.
Nobody
in case you
knew
didn't
that,
know.
Yeah.
And so I was working for an architect on 18th Street, and I was looking for a little extra dough, and started as a host at Union Square Cafe.
The venerable Union Square Cafe.
Right.
Which
exactly.
is, like, it really started a lot of things. I can recall when I was a chef, I remember being like, kind of, this sounds so dumb, but I have a visceral memory of it. I remember being like, holy cow, they put graham cracker crumbs in the breading for their calamari. That's genius.
I think it took a year for me to learn that secret. You know, it was like one of those things that I unlocked a book and told me.
Yeah. And then in fact, at the restaurant that I worked at that time, we took that and did it with ginger snaps instead.
Yeah.
So you have this kind of gingery bite on
the
corner.
Yeah, that sounds great. And it's still that great texture.
It would brown really quickly because it had some sugar in it, because you want to cook calamari really quick, but you still want it to be nice and brown, right? So sometimes just panko, it looks pallid, right?
Right, it does.
So this added like a layer of brown. It was crunchy and another layer of flavor. Like, I was like, oh my God, these guys are geniuses.
It's pretty cool because I think one of the reasons I've stayed with our company for so long is that there are so many sort of food geeks in our company. I love that. I've been surrounded by a lot of people who are really smart about things like that. And it's been really cool to sort of evolve, whether it was Union Square Cafe or Blue Smoke or other places that I'm at. Jazz Standard, I ran a jazz club for a while.
Well, yeah, you climbed the ranks at Union Square Union Square Cafe.
I clawed my way to the top.
From host all the way to GM.
From host to GM, yeah.
And that's no joke at any place, much less that place.
Enough people, you know, actually, it's one of those cool things that if you stick around long enough...
people just fall out of the way.
No, but also we were opening other places, so it was great. So in 1994, Gramercy Tavern opened, and then 11 Madison Park and Tabla opened. And so whenever that happened, it created a void somewhere. Either someone moved to go open that place, and I was able to maybe take their job. And then when Blue Smoke opened, finally I had kind of done every job or many jobs at Union Square Cafe. That was sort of my chance to open a new place. So that was pretty cool after 9 years.
Blue Smoke, the barbecue arm of the company, right?
Right.
And many locations of that as well.
Right. Yeah. And at the time, really the only places, really no one was really doing what we were trying to do with barbecue, which is really hard to believe for anyone who hasn't been in New York City for a long time. But at the time, it was kind of I don't want to say revolutionary because like that sounds really self-important, but it was something that people I really hadn't done, like taking this idea of barbecue and infusing it with amazing service and hospitality and really good desserts and side dishes. And doing it at a sort of New York way. We weren't trying to change the barbecue, but we were trying to really serve New Yorkers and tourists and things like that. So it was super fun to do that. I think easily took a few years off of my life doing that, as any opening does. I think our first, we averaged about 1,000 guests a day at Blue Smoke at for many years, including Jazz Standard, which was in the basement. And that was just really learning how to tame that tiger was pretty crazy.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes you ride it, sometimes it rides you.
Right. Yeah. And I think for years it was riding us.
Yeah.
You know.
But you got it under control, and then you opened several other locations of the same concept.
Yeah, opened at Battery Park City, opened at Citi Field, Washington Nationals Park, ultimately even JFK Airport. So kind of amazing to think, you know, that we've served a lot of people, you know, in different sort of neighborhoods and different parts of their lives, and it's been pretty fun.
Yeah, it's pretty outrageous to consider the volume that you do over there. But so to do that, you had to travel to sort of my neck of the woods, as we say, where I'm from, and you went down south a bunch to eat barbecue, check out barbecue.
And that really sort of planted the seed for me. I mean, I grew up in Connecticut, you know, so to me, down south was Manhattan. I didn't really have any exposure to the South except I think in middle school every kid does the pilgrimage, you know, to like Monticello. Right. That was and I think that's not necessarily the South.
Right.
To you Southerners, and so that's really where I first got exposed to the incredible hospitality and food and culture and music of the South and just how it's all woven together. Really one of the biggest things I did was join the Southern Foodways Alliance, which is just a really fantastic organization based out of Ole Miss in Oxford, Mississippi.
Yep.
And together, really with Danny and a few of his partners and John T. Edge of the Southern Foodways Alliance, we created the Big Apple Barbecue Block Party.
Yeah, which is crazy.
Which is crazy, which we've since sold a couple years ago, but... It was one of those amazing events that really sort of brought together the food and the music and the spirit of the South in New York City. And I really, that's really when my sort of love affair with the South began.
And so let's talk about Big Apple Barbecue for a second, because I love that thing. It's such a fun thing to go to. It's like, how many vendors are typically there?
We started with six our first year, and I think the last couple of years has been like 14 or 15. And it's funny, you know, you call them vendors. We call them the talent.
Yeah.
It was just kind of interesting because it was always meant to be a celebration of their craft. And that was just super fun for us. And you know, a bunch of New Yorkers, not that we were all from New York, but we were certainly running businesses in New York.
Right.
To really become a part of that family was pretty amazing.
Yeah. And then you roll up and you buy a ticket and you go in and you get to try all this barbecue from all over the place.
Yeah. And it was great because people, you know, as New York has so many transplanted people that, you know, there may be people who hadn't been back to Texas in a couple of years. And so they could find their favorite place from Texas or Mississippi or Illinois or
exactly.
You know,
everybody,
Memphis.
Yeah. You know, everybody goes home. That's the thing you want to, the heartstrings that you want to pluck on, I think, when you're serving people.
Right.
If you can remind them of something from home, you will win them every time.
Absolutely.
You know, a side story, I have a buddy who works in virtual reality, and he plugged me into the Google Maps virtual reality, which is free, by the way. If you've got the cardboard,
really?
You can slide your phone into the cardboard, and you do the thing. And he was watching on a screen what I was seeing inside the headset. And he said, just go somewhere. And at first, I went to Amore Margo, of course, the bar. And he said, no, just go somewhere. And I was like, okay. And he goes, where are you at? Because he could see it. There's a house, right? And he's like, where are you at? And I'm like, this is the house I grew up in. He's like, everybody goes home.
Wow.
Everybody.
That's amazing.
Like 100%.
All right, I got to do that tomorrow.
So, but what that's I'm great. Saying is that relates to our business in such
Absolutely.
A way where if you can give someone an experience or a delight that reminds them of home, mm-hmm. you really got them.
Yeah, we say
so. I'm the same. What I'm saying is I'm the same. I go to that Big Apple barbecue because I'm like, yeah, man, let's get some barbecue from home.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And it's fun and also if you can then share it with other people,
absolutely.
Who are pretty, you know, if you grew up in the rural section of Eastern Tennessee, you're maybe not likely to bring your friends there, but you might be able to sort of share that experience with them in some way in Madison Square Park in New York City.
So all your time at Blue Smoke, and then the Big Apple Barbecue, and then all that travel to the South. This is incubating the notion for what eventually becomes Porchlight.
Porchlight, yeah.
Talk about Porchlight.
Yeah, so Porchlight was our first standalone bar. And that was, it was really cool because in 2002, when we opened Blue Smoke, we were our first, Blue Smoke was our first sort of program, our first restaurant. And again, the Jazz Club is a really key component to it that had something other than wine as a major focus. All of our first four restaurants were very fine dining and either had very small beer lists and small cocktail lists or where those guests really gravitated towards wine. And so when we opened, we knew we were going to have a big beer list and a big spirits list of some sort. And eventually that became whiskey. Kind of makes sense with the Southern theme and cocktails. And, you know, I know you have the ultimate, you know, the people who listen to the show are mostly bartenders and people who really appreciate the spirits.
Nerds.
Okay. and we have a section on our menu at Porchlight called Nerdy.
Oh, nice.
But it's hard to imagine that in 2001, when we were designing Blue Smoke, that most places weren't squeezing their own juice. And you know, a lot of the cocktail bars on whose shoulders we stand weren't out yet. You know, they didn't exist yet.
Right.
So you weren't around yet for me to sort of copy off of. And so that was one of the most like crazy things that we did was we just started, you know, squeezing our juice like right before the shift. And, you know, of course, every bartender was like, there's no way that'll work. You know, and we were serving.
There's no way we'll be able to keep up. We can't do this.
Right.
What are you talking
exactly,
about?
Exactly.
Insanity.
You know, and my answer was usually like, do you like money? You know, people were willing. What we learned really quickly was that people were willing to spend an extra dollar on a real cocktail than something made with a canned or bottled juice. And they really noticed the difference. And so the challenge at Blue Smoke was that we didn't know, going back to the monster that it was, we didn't know what it was like to serve 120 margaritas a night. You know, so that kind of, that's a lot of juice and it really starts to add up. And that was only one of 12 cocktails, you know.
Right.
Unfortunately, our number one seller, at the time we had a margarita and a mojito sort of variation. The mojito came off the menu pretty quickly, unfortunately.
Right.
Because we literally couldn't serve 90 or 120 of those a night. It was pretty brutal.
Insanity. But that's great. And it's still shocking to me, because you say, like, who were we in 2001 to think that we should squeeze our own juice? Yet Union Square Cafe had been there.
Right.
And all the other concepts that came along, every bit of intent and focus is there on the food.
Right.
Why were cocktails left out, you think, back then?
That's a really good question, because, you know, we didn't even have cocktails printed on the menu at Union Square Cafe. 11 Madison and Tabla did have a cocktail list, and Gramercy Tavern did as well. I remember Nick Mautone, who was at Gramercy Tavern, he created a good cocktail list there. But it just didn't get the attention, I think, because of the people who were dining there. I mean, just to be frank, I mean, most people who can afford a really expensive dinner, they tend to be what is now my age or older, and they might get a Manhattan, which was a delicious Manhattan, but they didn't really care what the bartender was tinkering with. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's been really cool to see. And as a lot of our places have, we have either a casual portion of the business, like the tavern at Gramercy Tavern or the bar room at the Modern, or places like Porchlight, which are really just frankly less expensive. We have a much more diverse clientele who go there, and those people tend to be way more curious. So back in the day, in the 90s, you know, people were curious. They just weren't really, they didn't want to be adventurous with a cocktail.
Would you say that they're more curious and they're younger? Because you mentioned their age earlier. So you think,
absolutely.
So you've skewed younger.
Well, they're curious about different things, I think. Because they can't, you know, again, the Union Square Cafe guest at that time, actually, interestingly, the Union Square Cafe guest has gotten younger, which has been pretty cool for us. And I think that's largely because of our bar program, which is pretty cool. But, you know, most 25 or 30 year olds couldn't afford a $200 bottle of wine.
Right.
You know, but they might order at the time, you know, a $12 cocktail that didn't exist.
Right.
So that's what, when, as soon as we opened Blue Smoke, we started to see that, like, whoa. Okay, these you know, $11 cocktails are actually selling. That's pretty cool.
It was money you were leaving on the table.
Right, exactly.
You weren't identifying that people would spend that, so you weren't
right
pitching it to them, so right. Then they weren't ordering it. So then,
and then that's
the snake
what we started
eats itself. Yeah,
correct. And then that's what we started to notice, especially at Tabla, which unfortunately is no longer in business. But they ended up having a really young clientele that followed them with their cocktails. I think their problem was the space was just too big.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a break here and hear from our sponsors. Before we go away, though, I want to shoot a quick shout out to my buddy, Evan Freeman. He's my Heritage Radio Network Hall of Fame nominee for February 2019. We're doing Hall of Fame nominees each month to celebrate Heritage Radio Network's 10 years. Evan Freeman's my nominee because he's a pioneer in the cocktail world and just a general all-around good guy. And as a matter of fact, it happens to be his birthday today. So happy birthday to Evan Freeman.
Hey, Evan. Happy birthday.
Yeah, man. Cool. So we'll be right back with more from Mark Maynard of Union Square Hospitality Group.
This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. Featuring a variety of interactive displays, MOFAD encourages eaters of all ages to be curious about food. The museum currently operates MOFAD Lab, a 5,000-square-foot experimental space in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where Chow, making the Chinese-American restaurant, is currently on show until the end of March 2019. This exhibition celebrates the birth and evolution of Chinese-American restaurants, tracing their nearly 170-year history, and sparking conversations about food culture, immigration, and what it means to be American. It highlights the evolution timeline of Chinese-American restaurant menus, dating back to 1910, and also highlights a tasting section where participants get to enjoy tastings created by the country's most talented chefs who specialize in Chinese-American cuisine. Make sure you check out Chow while you still can. The exhibition closes at the end of March 2019. Check out MOFAD's tastings and extensive event calendar at mofad.org/events.
And we are back at the Speakeasy here at Roberto's Pizza in beautiful Bushwick, Brooklyn. In the studio today, got Mark Maynard from Union Square Hospitality Group. We've talked about your career starting as a very young man and a host at Union Square Cafe, then all the way up to general manager. Then you helped create Blue Smoke and all of its iterations. Then you got the bug from the South and created Porch Light, a bar that's kind of dedicated to all things Southern. And it's a standalone bar. It's still the only one, right?
We also opened a, well, it's the only cocktail bar to date. Dun, dun, dun.
Did I just crack into something?
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, you did.
Nice.
We also opened a wine bar called Vini Fritti.
Oh, right. That's
which
you too.
Is,
yeah.
Which is pretty cool. Which, again, we might have stolen part of your Amaro list.
That's fine. The high tide raises all boats.
Exactly. So that's our sort of Italian-focused wine bar.
Vini Fritti, wine and fries.
Vini Fritti. It's awesome.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
It's great. Where is that?
That's on 30 East 30th Street.
All right, cool.
Yeah, it's great. It's in the back of Marta, which is
cool. I've been to Marta several
lovely
times.
Lovely pizzeria, and next to it is Cafe Marchio, which is sort of an all-day cafe, pastries. So that's our sort of little Roman, part of our Roman Empire over there,
yeah,
which is pretty cool.
So you've got a book coming out called The Next Frontier of Restaurant Management. It's going to be published later this year.
I don't think you have any competition with it.
No, you're not, I'm not competing with your book.
Yeah. In fact, you know, it's funny. You did your book launch at Porchlight.
I did. You going to do yours at Amore?
Yeah, I think so. Because, I mean, what can you fit? Like 18 people there? You know, 25? Yeah.
Sure.
You know, there you go. thank you for that. I speak at Cornell on a regular basis, which is one of the more fun things I do. In fact, I'm going up there this weekend. Over time, I was asked to help write a textbook for the hotel school at Cornell. So that's been really fun. It's been a fun project, pretty scary project, actually. But I co-wrote it with someone who has like 5 PhDs, so he actually knew what he was doing.
I wish I had that guy in my corner.
Yeah, so he was the sort of play-by-play, and I did the color commentary. It was pretty cool. So I had to know enough to be dangerous, but he's the one who made sure I actually did everything properly. His name is Alex Suskind, and he's the associate dean of the hotel school, which is pretty cool.
So they approached you to write this book?
Yeah, well, he and I have been talking. So I've been speaking in his classes for probably 10 years or so.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I approached him about maybe writing an article together. And he said, hey, you know, I actually need to write a book as part of my my job here. So let's write a book together. And the premise of the book is that, you know, so many of us in the restaurant and bar business are intuitive, and that's what we use to guide us. He's a researcher. So he grew up in restaurants as well. But at a certain point, he pivoted towards research, and I pivoted towards operations, both in our probably 30s. And he really dives deep into researching every aspect of the guest experience. So he's presenting in the book. We present, I think, maybe 12 or 15 different studies, and he sort of interprets them as a researcher, and I interpret them as a guy who schmoozes for a living.
Right, right. You're reading it intuitively. He's reading it right by the data.
And so it's pretty cool. So it's I think what the subtitle of the book, which is coming out, I think, in June, is Leveraging Data to Improve the Guest Experience, Improve the Employee Experience and the Guest Experience. But that's not actually it. But it's something like that, yeah, where we talk about how to improve the lives of our employees and the lives of our guests.
Which is something you're always striving to do at your company.
Right. But it's rare that you actually have someone who can analyze what you're doing. So that's actually pretty fun.
To actually see data and crunch it. Because you're right. I think we do operate in an intuitive manner behind a bar or in service in general. You simply become better at reading people when you literally deal with hundreds of people a day.
Right.
You know, I don't know the data, but I do know that there's a wide disparity between the average person's interactions with human beings per day and mine.
Right. Exactly.
I don't know what that data is,
yep,
but I know it's huge.
And I think, you know, it's interesting because
10 to 1,000.
And you run three businesses right now. you know, sometimes it's like, well, why are things better on this night than on another night? Well, sometimes it's as simple as because person X is quicker at greeting guests.
Yeah.
You know, it's things like that.
Creates
that,
a better flow right
like
from the beginning.
It's really amazing that something like that can make an impact.
Well, speaking of caring for your guests and your employees, one of your employees, my good friend Nick Bennett, sent over this flask. What's in it?
So it's a reverse
holy cow
Presidente okay. cocktail.
I'm colorblind, but this is not a normal color.
So that is, trust me, that's bright blue. it goes really well with your red glasses. And so it's knowing that it was midday, and knowing that I'm a lightweight, he didn't want to give me only Ray and Nephew overproof rum. So what he did was this is more vermouth. It's our blend of dry and blanc vermouth, Ray and Nephew, and just enough blue curacao to be dangerous. So it's this bright blue baby, harkening back to his gunmetal blue that he created that will never come off the menu because it's too Instagrammed.
Yeah, no, let's talk about Instagram.
Yeah,
or let's not. Well, by the way, what did I just say? Let's talk about Instagram, and then what am I doing right now?
It's pretty embarrassing, people.
What am I doing right now?
He's taking a picture.
I'm taking a picture of this blue cocktail for Speakeasy Radio Instagram.
thank you, Nick Bennett.
Thanks, Nick B. He and I worked together twice. We worked together at Booker and Dax, and of course, he worked at Amore Margo many, seems like thousands of years ago.
That smells lovely.
It does smell lovely. Let's taste it. Whew.
Yeah, I'm glad that's not a 50-50.
Frankly, that's delightful. Yeah, it's delightful. Juicy and bright, and that Nick, he can mix a drink.
And now we probably shouldn't have it on, you could try it on the air without choking, but... our chef, Anton Nocito, also made you some salt and vinegar popcorn.
Oh, red.
Which is something that we're working on. It's for a new menu somewhere.
Oh, somewhere.
Somewhere. So it's actually kind of interesting that because we have popcorn on our menu at Porchlight, and it's just really incredibly addictive. So we're working on a new project, and he wanted to create something equally addictive. And it's also been kind of fun because Nick, he hopes to, with one of our new places, which I will talk about, one of them I could talk about, to kind of create maybe another sort of version of a Porchlight cocktail in the new bar, which would be kind of fun, where we have like these dueling things where theoretically people could go and try a different version of the same cocktail.
Sure.
If we ultimately have three or four bars.
Yeah, without cannibalizing, you're
right.
still offering a thread.
Like a different twist, which would be pretty fun.
So you got two more places opening up. You can't talk about one.
Yeah, but. So the one I can talk about is called Cedric's. It's called Cedric's at the Shed. The Shed is this awesome new arts organization in the Hudson Yards development that you've probably heard about. And it's this really, the coolest thing about this organization is that they really want to integrate all of the arts. So it's visual arts, performing arts. So everything from, painting and sculpture to dance and music. And they're one of the things that excited us most about this project and why we really got involved is that they want to sort of turn the arts institutions on their heads, and they're really skewing. They want to really attract 25 to 40 year olds, which is kind of going back to what we were saying earlier, is what is kind of who we take care of at Porchlight right now. And we think that's going to be a really fun thing and give us some ability to be a little bit more creative. And yet we want it to be a neighborhood bar.
Right.
It's going to have an entrance on 30th Street. So you can sort of approach it from either 30th Street or from within this, in the building
the big
itself.
Hudson Yard thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's going to be fun, and we're working on that, and that's like an April-ish opening.
Wow. So all right, coming up.
So yeah, we got a lot going on.
Cedric's at the shed.
We'll have a website eventually. I think we have a logo as of last night.
Nobody looks at websites anymore.
Yeah.
Internet's a dying thing.
Yeah, it'll never make it.
Right. Fad. And then you got another one that's on the horizon too, but you can't talk about that one.
Yeah, another one in the fall that I can't really talk about
yet. Right.
But that's another, what I've learned is that this whole neighborhood bar thing is pretty cool, as I tell the guy who knows how to run a neighborhood bar.
You know, I my story of success is skewed for sure. I still refer to Amore Margo as the bumblebee, which means, you know, it's not aerodynamically sound, but somehow it flies.
Right.
Blue Quarter, you know, I call Amore Margo the shoebox. Blue Quarter's the jewel box, right? It's adorable.
Right.
And then Windmill is our more neighborhoody one,
right.
Higher ceilings, brighter lighting, but with a French thread. So it's like a neighborhood bar in France.
But I think what's cool about Amore Margo is that even though it has a very sort of theoretically narrow focus, mm-hmm. you could walk in there and be incredibly well taken care of, as if you were like, if you, whether you were a tourist or whether you were an Amaro pilgrim. And I think that's kind of cool about it, that you have that ethos of a neighborhood bar, even though you have the sort of nerdiness behind it.
I mean, I think that you and your company have really been tip of the spear on putting hospitality first. But that's always been my focus as well.
Yeah.
You know, I try and remind myself and my staff that, you know, we're in New York City, man. There's literally thousands of bars where people can go and get just as good a drink. We have to be nicer.
Yeah.
Right. We have to be more hospitable. We have to be more welcoming, all those things. And that's what's gotten us where we are. I firmly believe that.
And as you know, that wasn't always the case.
Oh, no. God, no. Well, you know, we've talked about this on the show before. It was a phase we had to go through. You know, we had to kind of like put on our arm garters and wax up our mustaches and stomp our feet and say, look, we're serious about this.
Right.
Pay attention to how serious I am about this.
Right.
I'm going to be holier than you for a while. And when you finally get how serious I am about this and that it's a true thing and it's a profession and a career, then I can relax and wear my Hawaiian shirt to work and talk, you know, make jokes.
I loved the episode. I think you called it The Gatekeepers.
Yeah, yeah. That was a great episode.
That was one of my favorites, Daddy which is great.
And Paul from next door.
Yeah, which is pretty cool about.
Yeah, how those two run those doors.
Yeah.
So let's talk about a little bit about hospitality, but then let's jump into how you take care of your guests and the big controversy in the room, hospitality included over
dun,
there.
Dun. Bum, bum, well, it's not a controversy in this room. Well, maybe with you it is.
It is.
All right.
Get on your boxing gloves.
All right,
gloves.
Here we go. So our company, starting in 2015, Danny Meyer, started talking about, really wanting to professionalize the industry, which was something that was really important to him and, to us. And in a lot of different conversations and really a lot of a sort of journey that he went on, he decided, and then shared with us, his desire to eliminate tipping. And
big gasp,
dun dun.
Yeah.
especially talking to a bunch of bartenders. And so over the course of 3 years, most of our businesses, went from a tipping sort of model to a non-tipping model. And partially because, I was reluctant. And partially because Porchlight was a bar and we really wanted to learn from our predecessors and my peers, Porchlight was one of the last people, the last businesses to
adopt
sort
it.
Of convert. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so in November of this year, in November of 2018, a few months ago, we converted. And as I say with pretty much everything in life, the jury is still out, but it has been an incredibly smooth transition for most parties, and I think it's we're really trying to engage with the team because it's not perfect like a lot of things, and I know we're going to talk about, you know, the good and the bad and the ugly of hospitality included, and we invested a ton of time in each individual person talking about, you know, what their lives would look like in a non-tipping model. And Samantha Reiner, our general manager, and I, sat with every employee and sort of looked at their pay for the past, however long they had been there, whether it was 6 weeks or to some people 3.5 years of, this is how you've been paid over the past X number of months. And this is what it will look like in the future. And I worked with our accounting teams and financial analysts to really figure out how to make it work for all of us. And we're now a few months in, and it's going okay. Samantha, and she kind of, the way we played it was that she really wanted to sort of focus on the employee experience, and I wanted to focus on the guest experience. And just so we kind of each became an advocate for each sort of constituency. And so we talked a lot about, you know, how to make sure the pay was good while not alienating our guests. And then the other thing was to really help our back of house, our culinary team, make more money. Because even though our pay rates are considerably more than the average restaurant, you know, employee worker in the back of house, at our bar, since we were smaller, we were able to pay a little bit more. We wanted to still even give a little bit more, or have the ability for people to have a future in our industry, whether they're a prep cook or a bartender.
I can totally see that. You know, as a former back of the house guy, I was in the back of the house for 12 years. I can understand wanting to kind of spread the wealth a little, but I also understand what it means in New York City, especially. And we're seeing articles of all kinds of especially metropolitan areas that are struggling to find back of the house talent at the prices that we're able to pay, based on the fact that we have to sell that food at a price that the customer's still willing to pay for and pay the rent, right?
Right.
So I get that the squeeze is always on the back of the house.
Right.
But I'm still really, at face value, a little bit confused about how you go about thinking, let's take from one area and put to the other.
Well, that's actually an interesting premise to actually just sort of debunk a little bit. I think one of the things that we've done, I think just by your question, you're assuming that if a bartender made X, they're going to necessarily make a little bit less now to pay the back of house a little bit more. We have worked very hard to have that not be the case.
Right.
Now, what we, in the short term, we investors, we partners are the ones who are
bearing the brunt.
Mm-hmm. And that is absolutely on purpose, because we know we have 15 more years left in the Porchlight lease, and so we don't need to make it all tomorrow. And I think over time we're going to see how it plays out. But the intent is not to have anyone make less money. Are there cases where they do? Absolutely. Are there cases where they're making more? Absolutely. And so we've sort of, it's a really complex thing that I is both confidential and it probably wouldn't make sense to do on the radio. But we've developed this model with like all these pages of spreadsheets, where if you're the number one bartender or the number two bartender, you're being preserved, and we have a way of doing that based on your skill set and based on the hours you work. And it's something that we've had, again, I think we've had pretty good luck with, or pretty good fortune with. I don't think it's luck.
I say this all the time on the radio and in life, you know, the harder I work, the luckier I get.
Right,
so
exactly.
Sounds like you've done some work to get this luck.
Right. Now, I think it's interesting because one of the things that we've committed to the staff is that we are going to keep in touch with them. So we've had two monthly roundtables with the team to hear what they have to say, and it's not perfect. The other challenge is that each month is different. You know, January is a lot slower than December. So everyone was really happy in November, December, and guess what? In January and February, they're not as happy.
Normal.
Had they been tipped, they would have also made less money than, you know, that second week in December when we all that's the one week we all want to remember.
Right.
But honestly, one of the downsides, or something that we're, I don't know if it's a downside or just a readjustment, is that buzz of working. You're the service bartender and you get that walk-in of 30 people and you bang it out and you make an extra $80. That doesn't happen now because that money is now shared differently. And because those tips aren't all going to you.
Right.
And that was one of those things some of the feedback has been that adrenaline rush is something I'm missing out on a little bit. And so we frankly haven't solved that. But that's something where like a lot of us who've chosen the bar industry are doing it because of adrenaline. In addition to
for
money,
sure,
you know,
for sure.
Yeah, because there are certainly easier ways to make a good living in New York City. Adrenaline rush is awesome.
I firmly believe that if I don't go through all four gears in a single service, it basically wasn't worth it.
Right.
Like I need to hit fourth gear at some point.
Right.
Or it's just like, last night kind of sucked.
If you don't need a shower after work, then you haven't done your job.
Exactly.
Right, yeah. So I think those are some of the things that we're working on. And in fact, we're doing the staff may not even know this yet, but we're doing a survey next week with the staff, an anonymous survey where they can give us feedback, you know, anonymously. We only have 25 employees, but still, you know, not everyone may feel comfortable coming to a round table and speaking out either positively or negatively. Sometimes people don't want to be seen as the cheerleader if everything's going great for them, because again, there are some people who maybe for whom this is working really well.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So as you mentioned before, intuition is a huge part of what we do especially after I've been in this field literally all my life. I've been back in the house, in front of the house for, I don't want to talk about how long, but
yeah.
My dad owned a bar when I was a kid, I was 12 years old in that bar.
And you still went into the industry.
Yeah. Well, I went to the back of the house. I was chef first. But that intuition is still there. And that intuition to me is also based on, the informal data that I've collected over my own life, which says that when I go to places, and when I say places, I mean countries.
Right.
When I go to countries where there is no tipping culture, say France, Spain, Italy, I feel like the one thing that I care the most about, and I think that you care the most about, is the thing that suffers. Does the food suffer? No. Does the wine suffer? No. Does the service suffer? Hell yeah.
That's really interesting, because I just last week came back from Barcelona, and I've told this story to the staff, or some members of my team a few times. So there's a bar there called Paradiso, which is getting a ton of press. One of the best bars in Barcelona for sure. And I was concerned that I was going to go to this place and it was going to be super, snooty. It's hard to say, just, and one of the amazing things that I found, because it's one of these cocktail bars where they have things foaming and smoking and things like that. And I was like, okay, I'm going to go there.
Because all the bells and whistles.
Right. Everyone's telling me that I have to go there, and I couldn't go to Barcelona without going there. And so part of my expectation was that it was going to be, kind of a D-bag place. And I walked in the door.
I've been trying to watch my language this episode, because I know.
No, you can say whatever you want, And so I walked in the door, and every single bartender, there's four of them, turned and said hello.
Right.
And if you've ever been to a Waffle House, which I know you have.
Of course. That was my first cooking job.
That is one of those things. Like, I felt I was walking into a Waffle House. Meanwhile, it was only candlelight. It could not have been darker. Everyone was dressed in black and, it's super trendy. And I was like, that's amazing. That bartender has two shakers in his hand. They don't allow too deep at the bar. It's everyone's sitting. It's quite busy. And as they the door must creak open. Yeah. And every single person said, hello.
Right.
Actually, what they said was, ¿qué tal?
Right. It's like going into a Japanese restaurant.
And so I didn't feel like, I don't feel like the service suffered.
So we're splitting hairs here, but that's hospitality.
Okay.
Service is another thing, right?
True.
I feel like my intuition is that when I'm in France and I go to lunch and I say, I'm going to have a glass of wine and the salad of frisée, followed by the salmon entree, and maybe we'll talk dessert later. And then my wine doesn't come until I'm finished with my frisée.
Right.
So now there's a loss of service, right? Okay, so I'm feeling like, where was my wine the whole time with my salad? But then also I think to myself, okay, not just on service, on business.
Right. If that guy had capitalist in you.
If that guy had delivered that wine on time, I would have ordered a second glass for my entree.
Right.
But meanwhile, this one just arrived when my entree did. So now the house is losing. I'm not as happy as I could be as the guest. Right. So, and I feel like all of that comes down to the fact that the incentive for him to work harder, him or her to work harder, isn't there like it is in our country.
Right.
Which says that if this guy serves me well, I'm going to treat him well. Right.
Yeah, I think a lot of that's going to come down to the hiring process, and our job as leaders is always to lead. And one of the things that we look for When we hire people is people who are intrinsically motivated. You know, I can't teach you to want to work hard. Nope. You know, and I can't teach you whether you're motivated by money or just by whatever self-esteem to want to take care of people. And you know, so we focus a lot on sort of what your parents taught you, not what I can teach you. Right. I might be able to, or not I, Nick Bennett might be able to take you how to teach you how to make a better cocktail. But I can't teach you how to be nice or how to really want to do things well. And so I like to surround myself with people like that. And that's been one of the luxurious parts of my job is that since I get to do a lot of the hiring, is that I get to surround myself with a lot of people who are motivated by themselves without me.
Right.
You know, telling them to show up to work on time or whatever. So I don't know. I mean, I think, again, jury's still out, but like a place like The Modern, which was our first hospitality included business, is doing really well. It's doing really well in terms of their, you know, scores on Yelp. It's doing really well financially.
What do you say about employee turnover?
Employee turnover is initially it was a situation. And I think a lot of that was fear. And also, again, they were the first ones.
They were the first, yeah.
Yeah, so I feel very fortunate that I've been, I'm 3 years after The Modern. But we've actually had... we've had a very good experience with that at Porchlight. And again, it's been 3 months, but we've had a very good experience with hospitality included so far.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm glad you're having a good time at it. I'm glad it's working out for you. I'm still not convinced.
Oh, well, there you go. And I think, I'd love to see. The other thing is I'm not here to convert anyone.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's something that's really important. It's whatever works for you.
Yeah, of course. You know, I don't run my business the way you run your business in many ways, and that's okay. I think our ultimate goal, though, is our ultimate goals are pretty similar. One, I want to be known for being a hospitable, welcoming place.
Right.
Two, I want to serve good product. And three, I want to make money doing that.
Yep.
So that's kind of the three guiding factors for me. And I'm sure they're similar for you.
Yeah, they are. And I think for us, you know, we have the staff experience as really number one, you know? So for us, like given the sort of principles of our business, if Danny thought hospitality included would make it a horrible place to work, then that really
probably would have been out the door.
And so, you know, I think we've done a pretty good job of that so far. And again, I'm being really cautious here because we're the newbies doing this, you know.
Yeah, well, we're
12 weeks in.
You mentioned your co-author does more data. I'd be very interested to see what he can compile over the next couple of years to be, you know, something we can look at as data.
It's funny. As a matter of fact, we actually talked about doing a chapter on that in the book, but we didn't have enough data to do it. So I think that'll be the second edition.
Yeah, right on.
Yeah.
Is your book going to be available in bookstores?
Is this more of an academic book? Right. I think, no, it will be available through Cornell University Press, probably through Amazon and Barnes & Noble, but I doubt it'll be right next to the John Grisham books at Hudson News and JFK Airport. But it'll definitely be
a riveting read.
You know, wait, what should I get?
To
Men's Health or this?
Yeah.
You know, it'd be right next to the In Style.
Well, awesome. Mark Maynard, it's been a real pleasure having you on the show with us today. Thanks for taking some time out of your busy schedule over there at Union Square Hospitality Group and Porchlight and all the other things you have going on. Let's talk real quickly before we shut it up. The classes that you do, are they just for Cornell students or are they like adjunct classes?
The ones I do up there are for Cornell students, either undergrad or grad students. But it's funny, Cornell is actually working on a summertime institute, which I hope to get involved with, which would be for
consumers.
For consumers, yeah.
Cool.
Which is cool.
Well, maybe you'll let me sneak up there and audit a class or something.
Hey, audit a class. We want you to teach a class.
Yeah.
Let's go.
I want that too. Let's do it.
Just don't go in February like I'm going next week.
I'm trying to change my persona. I want to become, you know, more known as a teacher.
We can work on that.
An informational, resource.
All right. I'm sure someone from Cornell is listening right now. So We'll make sure they email you.
Yeah, hit me up. All right, so that's it for this week's Speakeasy. I want to mention once again, on the 24th of February, I'm going down to New Jersey to see Francis Schott at his place, Stage Left. What's going on down there? We've got Martini, History, Culture, Technique, and Drinking with Dale DeGroff. Dale's going to hang out with Eric Anderson and talk about Hendrick's Gin, their new Orbium, which is infused with quinine, wormwood, and blue lotus blossoms. So, you know, I'm totally interested because it's got quinine and wormwood in it. It's a bitter gin. It goes great in gin tonics. I'm excited to taste one in a martini. This is not a plug that they paid for. This is just a thing I'm doing, and I want people to come do it with me. So,
but you might owe Eric $20 or something.
Yeah, whatever. Mm. So if you've got time, Sunday, February 24th from 3:30 to 5 in New Brunswick, New Jersey, come hang out with me. I'm going to stay afterwards and have a steak at Stage Left Steakhouse and hang out with Francis Schott. So love to see you all there. That's it for this week's Speakeasy. See you soon, guys. Cheers.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The
want more of the Speakeasy? Follow us and ask questions on Instagram at Speakeasy Podcast or on Twitter at Speakeasy Radio. You can find Damon at Damon Bolte, and you can find me at Creative Drunk on all platforms. Take a moment to write us a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite platform and give us a star rating, 5 if possible. If you're visiting New York City or a resident, stop by the studio and hang out with us during an episode. Reach out beforehand to make sure we'll be here. We'd love to see you. And please support our show by visiting heritageradionetwork.org and clicking on the beating heart to donate.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family and become a member. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.